This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The number of uninsured Americans went down every single year starting in 2008, and the number continued to drop after the Affordable Care Act went into effect until 2018. For the first time in a decade, the number of uninsured Americans went up by about 2 million people. And a new report shows that between 2016 and 2018, when the number of uninsured Americans was still going down, the number of uninsured children rose by double digits. Why? And how does Indiana factor in? Joining me in the studio now is Mark Fairchild, Director of Policy and Communication at Covering Kids and Families of Indiana. Thanks for coming in, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Mueller is Advocacy Director for Indiana Legal Services. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
Joan, we'll start with you. Can you explain what the report was that you co-wrote recently, the Uninsured Kids Report? What was your goal?
Sure. So this is the ninth time we've written this report, and we try to track children's health insurance coverage levels every year. And as you mentioned in your intro, this has actually been a good news report for many years. But unfortunately, since 2016, the last 2 years, we've gone in the wrong direction. Over 400,000 children became uninsured during that period. We now have over 4 million uninsured children in the country. And Indiana was one of the states where we saw a statistically significant increase in the rate of uninsured children.
What is the Center for Children and Families there at Georgetown?
So we are a nonpartisan public policy research center, and we try to provide data and education about public policy solutions to make sure that children and families have access to high-quality, affordable health coverage. We don't take any government funding or any funding from drug companies or anything like that. We're all foundation-funded, and we do this kind of public policy research and strategic thinking to help promote good solutions for kids and families.
You've outlined four key findings in the report, so I wanted to talk about each of those. The first is the number of uninsured children in the United States increased by more than 400,000 between 2016 and 2018, bringing the total to over 4 million uninsured children in the nation, just as you said. Can you talk about what trends we're seeing in the years leading up until this point? You said that it was good news up until then.
That's right. So for many years, there's been a bipartisan commitment to reducing the number of uninsured children in the country. And that really started back in the 1990s. And with the passage of the Children's Health Insurance Program in 1997, there's been a lot of effort and activity over the years to try to reduce the number of uninsured children. And that has been quite successful. The Affordable Care Act was really kind of the cherry on top of the sundae for kids in terms of driving down their uninsured rates further, and that's when we hit the lowest number of uninsured children in 2016. But, of course, as we've discussed, since that time, for the past couple of years, that trend is going in the wrong direction.
So from the outside, as someone who's been thankfully insured all that time and have just more or less followed the news, it seems to me that the Affordable Care Act would be the biggest reason why so many more people and, of course, children are getting insurance. But you say that efforts were in place ahead of that and that the ACA was just the bonus to help things along?
Yeah, for children, we have had efforts for many, many years, starting in the 1990s with expanding Medicaid for kids and then the passage of the Children's Health Insurance Program, which has been was revised and extended, particularly in 2009. So, again, this was a bipartisan commitment to, which frankly really came out of the ashes of the Clinton health reform effort. Congress then passed the CHIP program, and states moved to implement that. So it's been a steady decline, and the Affordable Care Act absolutely accelerated that decline in the number of uninsured children.
Now, with regards to the drop, the rise in uninsured children between 2016 and 2018, we'll get into more details throughout the show, but what seem to be some of the biggest factors in that change nationwide?
Right. So we do see a number of national trends that are unfortunately driving this in the wrong direction, and I'll talk about those in a moment. But just to note, it's particularly troubling that during a period of low unemployment, when the number of uninsured kids should be going down, it's going up. So should an economic downturn occur, which we know it will, the child uninsured rate will increase more rapidly. So that's very concerning. But here's what we think is leading to the cause in the rise of uninsured children. There are a few factors at work. The first is most uninsured children, and this is definitely true in Indiana, are eligible for your Medicaid or your children's health insurance program, but they're not enrolled or they've lost coverage. And Mark can speak to this. He works with these families every day. But unfortunately, after 2017, when there was so much discussion about repealing the Affordable Care Act, cutting Medicaid, and CHIP was delayed, Congress had to extend CHIP, but they, in unprecedented move, delayed that for months, families were getting lots of messages that coverage was going away. At the same time, the Trump administration cut funding for outreach and navigators, so we had fewer resources on the ground to help these kids find coverage. Secondly, there's a chilling effect going on, particularly with Latino families, where the children are citizens, they are eligible for Medicaid, but their parents are scared to enroll them, even though this should not be held against them for any kind of deportation or public charge issue. With all of the hostility right now towards immigrant families, they're scared, and we see those Latino children have high uninsured rates, and that's true in Indiana as well. And then lastly, there's just some more subtle kinds of red tape, more red tape and barriers that are being put up to coverage at the state level, encouraged by the federal government.
Another key finding in your report is that these coverage losses are widespread, with 15 states showing statistically significant increases in the number and or rate of uninsured children. These states are Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Montana, North Carolina, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia. I feel like I just sang the 50 state song, but there's just 15 of them. But that's still significant. Are there any common threads you saw in this diverse group of states with respect to these changes?
Well, you know, the fact that it is such a diverse group of states, I think, speaks to this overriding national negative climate that we're in. And that's why we think these national trends that I talk about are really what's driving this. But, you know, one thing to note, in general, more uninsured children are clustered in the South. But Indiana is, unfortunately, a little bit of an outlier. Indiana is the only state in the Midwest to have a higher uninsured rate than the national average. And it is a state, of course, that went in the wrong direction, as you just indicated. So as a region, the Midwest is doing better for kids than the national average, but unfortunately Indiana is the exception to that state of affairs.
Mark, can you explain what Covering Kids and Families of Indiana is, where you work?
Yes. We're a group that focuses on getting people signed up for health care coverage. It's known as navigator work. So we have state-certified individuals that are experts on all these different programs that we're talking about today, how to get them signed up, keep them signed up for coverage, and hopefully get them better health outcomes as a result.
So Indiana is in that list of states with significant increases in the number and or rate of uninsured children. What's your reaction when you see that? Are you surprised?
We're always surprised to see that because Indiana is a state that has definitely embraced doing a lot of work around children's health coverage specifically. While we're very low in a lot of health outcomes nationally, sadly so, with children's health coverage, we're at least towards the middle of the pack and moving in the right direction most of the time. So definitely a surprise and not a very positive one at that.
What kinds of things factor into whether kids are insured or not in Indiana?
Well, there's a lot of different things, but the most important aspect is there's coverage programs for almost any child out there. So it's rarely that there's something that they don't qualify for. It's a matter of the knowledge of the consumer, whether that person's wanting to or interested in taking help, but whether they understand that there's a dozen large and small programs out there and how to navigate those and connect with those. It's a very, very overwhelming process. And when you're hearing media reports about things like Affordable Care Act might be gone, we have to remember for the consumer, that's a technical term to us, but for them it just means my options are gone, even though it doesn't impact things like the Children's Health Insurance Program and some of the other ones we're talking about.
Well, let's talk about the about CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. What is that?
Right. So that's a program specifically meant to catch those kids that are at that near poverty level. It covers up to 262% of the federal poverty level, which can be a substantial family income, but not enough to necessarily be fully self-sufficient. And it's meant for the concept that if anybody's going to be covered in the household, we want to make sure the kids are covered. And what the outcomes can be with that if we don't have them covered can be very dire.
And are the enrollment rates low for CHIP in Indiana?
They're not necessarily low, but we do find that Indiana, when we compare to other states, so right now we have kids that are eligible for either CHIP or Medicaid, about 88% are signed up. But that actually puts us about fifth lowest in the country for the sign-up rate. So that remaining 12% is a very large 12%.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think we're 12% behind?
A lot of different things. We've definitely been in the center of a lot of the politics. And again, when people hear things like that, they make a certain assumption that those options aren't there for them anymore. We've got some other interesting rules, such as if a child currently had insurance or recently lost insurance, they need to wait 90 days before they can sign up for the CHIP program. We're one of a minority of states that have that approach. So if somebody lost their job or couldn't afford their employer-sponsored insurance and approached this program for help, they'd be told to wait 90 days. And we know for a lot of folks that probably means they're going to go look for other options or maybe not come back at all to that program. So, but that's just one example of how all of these different things within the system can be confusing for parents, and it makes them not want to engage and not want to push further, and especially if they're thinking there's a good chance that they'll get denied at the end of the day.
Mark Fairchild is from Covering Kids and Families of Indiana, and we've been also talking with Joan Alker from the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. Adam Mueller from Indiana Legal Services is still with us, and we'll keep the conversation going with all three of them. And up next, we'll talk about a federal lawsuit that challenges certain elements of Medicaid programs in Indiana, which has caused the state's work requirement program to be temporarily suspended. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What do you think about the current state of Medicaid in Indiana? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on Medicaid, I want to tell you about our last show where we talked about the legacy of Indianapolis native Kurt Vonnegut and the new permanent home for the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library opening this weekend. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Today, we're discussing issues around Medicaid and uninsured children in Indiana. And as always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're joined again by Mark Fairchild, Director of Policy and Communication at Covering Kids and Families of Indiana, and Adam Mueller, Advocacy Director for Indiana Legal Services. And on the phone, we have Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. Adam, how do you interact with this issue at Indiana Legal Services?
With the uninsured children's issue? Yeah, so by and large, we don't have to because it's typically been a pretty good program for our clients and our their kids. We have heard anecdotally from members in the community that Latino families specifically have been concerned about going, you know, accessing certain services. Like, for instance, we've heard anecdotally that libraries, where people often congregate, they're not doing as much anymore in like rural communities. And so even if those kids, as Joan mentioned, would be eligible for this insurance because they are U.S. citizens, there's a more of a community fear or concern that is keeping them from signing up.
Joan, the third key finding in your report is about demographics, the loss of coverage. It's most pronounced for white children and Latino children, some of which may fall into both categories, young children under the age of six, and children in low and moderate income families that earn between 138% and 250% of the poverty line, I guess. Can you talk about how much these groups stand out and what's behind some of these distinctions?
Yeah, and I wanted to note, as you said, we did see a bigger increase, not for the poorest kids, but for those just over the poverty line, those families earning between about $30,000 to $50,000 a year. And as Mark talked about, you know, these families do face a waiting period in your CHIP program, and we do see that they have the highest rate of uninsurance in Indiana, about 10% of children in those income groups. And, you know, that's because their parents are working, but they're working in jobs that are not providing affordable health coverage, particularly for their children. So that's the key issue, and I think speaks to, on the plus side, that there are some things the state could do that would right away make the situation better. Getting rid of that 90-day period of waiting, which is essentially forcing a child to be uninsured for 90 days, would be a great start. Making sure that kids are covered for a year once they sign up so they don't, the family doesn't have to worry about renewal. Those are some of the policy changes that the state could make.
Mark, we've heard about some challenges with immigrant communities in the state. What issues have you seen there? We've talked a little bit about them already.
Right, absolutely. And there's been several big national pieces of legislation that have been floated, some of which haven't even gone into place, but that have given the concept that if you get health insurance for your family, if you get health insurance for your children, that could be weighed against you either as far as risking deportation or being held against you for getting your green card and other things like that, which the interesting reality is that that's not true, but the fear has gotten instilled in those communities. So if your children gets health coverage through CHIP or Medicaid and another program, that actually can't be traced back to tag your immigration status, potentially get you in trouble, or risk your ability to get to that higher status, getting your green card and moving towards citizenship. But once those fears are in the community, it's very, very hard to pull that back. So we're definitely seeing that effect.
And outreach is part of sort of addressing that, right? I would imagine. I mean, how active are organizations in sort of telling these people, look, you shouldn't be worried about this?
Right. And that's a huge part of what we do, is really trying to get down out there and make those connections, connecting with their community leaders, because otherwise we're just a voice from Indianapolis coming down using a whole lot of jargon and terminology, which it can be difficult even for our audience here today sometimes, I'm sure. So we need to make those connections, work through that. And we do also work with the state. The state right now is doing a major rebranding process for their children's health insurance program, trying to look at how they can connect better to some of these communities, get the information out better, pull it in with a lot of their other services and support, so it's all bundled together into one good cohesive message. Because that's part of the problem too. There's a lot of different programs and letters and initials behind them all, and they realize they've got to do some work there. So they're working on that part. We're working on being the folks on the ground communicating that message as well as we can.
Joan, the fourth and final key finding from the report states that states that haven't expanded Medicaid to parents and other adults under the Affordable Care Act have seen increases in their rate of uninsured children three times as large as states that have. How significant was this difference, and what did you take from it?
Well, it's very significant, and we know that when parents are covered, that children are more likely to be covered as well. Of course, that's not an issue in Indiana because you do have HIP. We're going to talk, obviously, about the work requirements, but you have Medicaid expansion. So that means, I think, that the state really needs to look at specifically your children's coverage options, how to put the welcome mat out for them. And just to note, last week in response to the report, seeing your neighbor, Governor DeWine in Ohio, actually called a cabinet meeting to talk about this very concerning trend that the number of uninsured children is rising in his state. So, you know, if state leaders and hopefully there's an interest there, raise these issues, make things easier for families, and really put out the welcome mat, start talking about this issue and how they want to make it better, I think that can make a real difference.
Now, considering Indiana actually expanded our Medicaid program, were you surprised to see Indiana on that list of states where this is such a problem?
I was a little surprised. A lot of these states are clustered in the South where they haven't expanded Medicaid, but that's not exclusively the case. As I mentioned, Ohio also saw a rise, West Virginia also has expanded Medicaid. So I think that means you have to really look to some of your policies, like the 90-day waiting period, like signing up kids for 12 months and not making the families renew. But it also speaks to this larger climate where the Latino families are feeling worried, and this kind of more red tape that we're seeing around the country. So, again, there's room here for state leaders to really come out and say, we want to turn this around. We know it makes sense. We know that kids who have Medicaid have better health outcomes. They have higher high school graduation rates. And better economic outcomes as adults. So there are many reasons why this is a really important issue to try to turn around. This data should be a red flag.
Joan, were there any other interesting takeaways from the report that we haven't yet gotten to?
You know, we've talked about most of them. I think we talked about the families who are in these sort of low to moderate age working families. So one other thing I wanted to mention is we did see across the country a rise in very young children's uninsured rates. Typically, children who are school-aged have higher uninsured rates, and that's still true overall because babies, toddlers are in the doctor's office all the time, and so they're more likely to have been enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP. But we do see a troubling rise for these babies and toddlers in uninsured rate, and that's really problematic. Any parent knows you're in the pediatrician all the time. They've got to get their immunizations. They need to get their developmental screenings. So really important to pay attention to those very young children here.
Mark, let's go back to the Medicaid expansion in Indiana. Can you talk about what that expansion looked like here? What does it mean that state leaders expanded the Medicaid program?
Right, right. And it's important to note, too, that we expanded Medicaid before Medicaid expansion was even the term of the day. So back in 2007, 2008, we started building that, so well before the Affordable Care Act was in place. And it was built because we cared about the folks that were seeing that were uninsured and what their health outcomes would be. It was one of the things that's rare these days. It was a very bipartisan approach, and everybody worked together. It actually, in the beginning, only covered a few thousand people, and now we're over 400,000 very regularly. So a great deal of thought went into that about making sure that we were hitting that and that we were protecting the hospitals from the cost of uncompensated care, that we were getting people preventative services. So it really did turn into a national model. So when Medicaid expansion became the term of the day, it was something that a lot of states looked to for how it could be done, especially if they needed bipartisan buy-in to make it something their state would see as feasible.
We're talking about Medicaid in Indiana, and we've been talking about the number of uninsured children in Indiana and 15 other states seeing a significant rise from 2016 to 2018. And now we're going to pivot to talking about the lawsuit that has suspended Indiana's Gateway to Work program with regard to Medicaid benefits. Adam, let's get into this lawsuit and some of the history behind it.
Okay.
Medicaid recipients in Indiana are required to report employment or volunteer hours to receive benefits through a program called Gateway to Work. Can you explain how this worked in practice?
Yes. Yeah, so about 70,000 folks who are on the Medicaid expansion that we call HIP were subject to what's called the work requirements, or more technically known as Gateway to Work under Indiana. And this program rolled out over the course of 2019 with a graduated hour requirement each month. So, for instance, January through July, there was a 0 hour requirement. And then July, it was 5 hours a week. And then it moved up in September, I believe, then October. And eventually, when it reached full capacity, folks would be looking at having to do 20 hours a week. And the requirement was that you would report your hours either to your health insurance plan or to through a portal on the state's website.
What was the thinking behind the program? What effect did they hope it would have?
Well, I can tell you what the state's rationale is, and we can talk a little bit about that. I'm sure that Joan and Mark can probably also chime in. But the idea behind it is that now, taking a step back, the Medicaid Act doesn't actually allow for you to do work requirements. This is what was known as a waiver. So you've got Medicaid expansion, and then you pile this waiver provision on top of it. Mm. And previous to 2017, no state had ever been allowed to do a work requirement, but that policy changed in 2017 with the new administration. So the rationale behind it is supposed to be that that there's a connection between being healthier and employment. But what we actually sort of know from the literature, from all of the studies that have been done on this issue, it's actually sort of a reverse issue, that it's not that being employed makes you healthier. Vice versa, you have to really be healthy in order to maintain employment. As I like to say, it's like saying being in the NBA makes you a taller person, when in fact it's the opposite.
Good analogy. How did this lawsuit come about then?
We on behalf of four individuals, we filed the lawsuit in September and challenged. Basically, we filed it against the Federal Health and Human Services Agency, challenging the approval of these particular waiver provisions, the work requirements, as well as several other provisions. And in many ways, it's the same lawsuit that folks have seen in Kentucky and Arkansas and New Hampshire.
Joan, have similar issues around work requirements happened in other states?
Yes, they have. And the only state that actually implemented their work requirement before the judge stepped in and stopped it was the state of Arkansas. And unfortunately there, the concerns that Mark outlined were really borne out. It didn't help anybody get a job, but it did cause widespread losses of coverage. About 18,000 people in Arkansas lost their health insurance. So what these lawsuits are really about is the Secretary of Health can give states waivers in the Medicaid program, but he doesn't have unlimited authority. So these lawsuits are really about an executive overreach here, and that any waivers have to comport with the fundamental objectives of the Medicaid program. And, of course, the fundamental objective of the Medicaid program is to provide health insurance for needy people. And since these work requirement policies are not doing that, in fact, they're leading to the opposite outcome, as we saw in Arkansas. So far, all of the challenges in court have gone against the secretary, and four states three have been halted. And the case is currently before the Court of Appeals for some of the other states.
Well, let's try to contrast Indiana a little bit, if we can. Does Indiana's work requirement program work differently in any important ways than how other states have done it?
Not really. I mean, you could say that Indiana's is a little bit softer in some respects, but ultimately the kind of defining feature that all these states have is that essentially they're applying a stick here. They're saying to the Medicaid beneficiary, we're going to take away your health insurance if you don't get a job. And that's what the change in the law that the waiver was trying to achieve. But the judge has said that's an overreach here. You're not allowed just to make up the law. That's Congress's job. And that's why we've seen the other states have to pull theirs back.
Let's go back to looking at the other states. How have fights about this gone in court?
Well, there have been three states so far, Arkansas, Kentucky, and New Hampshire, where this was challenged in a similar way, and all of those states had to stop implementing their programs. Interestingly, we saw on the election Tuesday, Governor Bevin of Kentucky was a real proponent of work requirements, and the appearingly incoming governor-elect Beshear, the Democrat, was very much against them. So it was a big issue, I think, at the ballot box in Kentucky, and so that was very interesting. Right now, the Trump administration has filed an appeal. Oral arguments were heard in that, and I think the appeals court is probably going to uphold these rulings where the secretary cannot approve these kinds of work requirement waivers.
Adam Mueller, the advocacy director for Indiana Legal Services, is with us. Adam, what do you want the court to find as a result of the lawsuit?
We want the court to find that the approval by the federal government of the provisions that we're we're alleging are illegal, that to find that those should never have, that should never have taken place. Or there's a term for it for administrative law called that the approval is arbitrary and capricious or otherwise against the law. So we're asking that that action approving those pieces be set aside.
So Indiana has suspended work requirements for Gateway to Work. Why did that happen?
Well, I can just tell you what I read in the press release is that they suspended it because of the we filed the lawsuit and because the case is also playing the issue is also playing out in other courts. And so the so as the state said, while it's still being sort of resolved, we would like to hit pause. The sort of the anecdotal reports that we had heard is that the compliance with the program was low. And I also want to make a distinction that the compliance with the program doesn't mean whether or not people were actually working or volunteering or doing other things in the community. It's whether or not they were reporting these hours either via their health plan or the system. And that we've heard anecdotally as well that that process is confusing, unclear exactly how it's supposed to work, what you need to report, those sorts of things. And I also want to go back one step to say, and what's interesting in Arkansas is that of the 18,000 people that lost their coverage, not everybody got back on Medicaid after it was suspended.
Before we get to our next break, I want to thank Joan Alker. Joan is executive director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. She'll be leaving us for the next segment. Thanks for calling in, Joan.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll be back with Mark and Adam in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on Medicaid and a legal challenge for a benefit program that includes work requirements. We're joined again by Adam Mueller, Advocacy Director for Indiana Legal Services. Thanks for sticking around, Adam.
Sure.
And Mark Fairchild, Director of Policy and Communication at Covering Kids and Families of Indiana. Thanks, Mark.
No problem.
Mark, what does the suspension of requirements for this program look like? Is it having an effect on people who were using it or creating confusion?
Yeah, and we can only assume it will. Anytime there's a big, large-scale system change, there'll be confusion. With this requirement, though, it's interesting. So reporting of hours was something that was opened up earlier in the year. And we saw a different trend than we usually do. A lot of times we'll see a lot of consumers calling us and having issues, not sure what's going on. And we get a lot of that over the phone lines when we see a big systemic change like this. This one, while there was some of that, it was a very quiet time rather than what we were really expecting to have in. So there is a suggestion that consumers never really got a full understanding of what this was, how the system worked, how to report hours. We know reporting at least early on, very few people were logging in to the website for reporting and clocking hours. So we still are kind of left in this mystery zone of what we're dealing with. Is it consumers that didn't understand it at all? We've had anecdotal reports that some were just keeping a separate notebook of their hours and we're going to put in at the end of the year, like most of us procrastinators in the audience tend to do. But it left us not knowing a real good measure of was any of it working at all? Or was the system understood by consumers at all? Because we didn't get to that point of really measuring it after a full reporting cycle came in.
Is there any worry about the scope of this lawsuit that it might end up removing more than it intended?
I think there's some that are looking at that. So again, to back up to Adam's discussion on it. So the Healthy Indiana Plan is built out of traditional Medicaid expansion with a whole bunch of what are called waivers around it. So lots of different things that they can change and tinker with that they feel work best for the state of Indiana. Some of those being very good things. Substance use disorder, which is a big national issue and an Indiana issue too, we get an increased reimbursement rate because of a waiver that we applied towards that and better access to providers because of a waiver we put towards that. The Healthy Indiana Plan offers more than traditional Medicaid does for reimbursement and for all services, and that got a lot of providers on board and gave us a much bigger network of providers than traditional Medicaid would have. That's due to the 1115 waiver program that we're discussing here today. And there's a last one that's actually still pending approval that would, for folks that end up making too much income because they're doing better financially to qualify for the Healthy Indiana Plan anymore, it'd give them $1,000 to purchase coverage to fill that gap in coverage until they get employer coverage or something else lined up. Another very positive thing that both myself and Adam would love to still see those things continue. So there's always fear that it's going to cause states to just back away entirely and say, we're out of this. We're not going to do Medicaid expansion in any form anymore. But we've got so many Indiana consumers, again, over 400,000 using this program. That seems unlikely. It's certainly something we watch closely, though.
Yeah. Adam, are you worried about that at all?
No. Medicaid expansion is the law of the land in Indiana. We expanded Medicaid, and I can tell you from my client's experience, this has been a really positive thing. So importantly, looking at what Mark just described, the pieces like the substance use disorder waiver or some of those other things that are related to that, those would be legal and good uses of the 1115 waiver because they fulfill the mission of the Medicaid law, which is to increase access to health coverage and to see better health outcomes. So from our perspective, those are sort of the good things that we want to see for our clients.
The Indiana Family and Social Services Administration, or FSSA, told us that they couldn't participate in the show today because of the ongoing legal case. They did put out a statement when the suspension for work requirements was announced, saying it was suspended because of the legal challenge. The statement also says that the lawsuit potentially jeopardizes the HIP program as a whole. And Medicaid Director Allison Taylor says, quote, "We remain committed to operating the Gateway to Work program and continuing to build on the early successes of the program, through which HIP members are reporting successful engagements in their workplaces, schools, and communities," end quote. Mark, you talk with people at the FSSA for your work. Can you talk at all about how they might approach this?
Right, because it's important to note that there's still an opportunity here. So if the intention was to get people to a better place, health-wise, moving them out of poverty, tackling a lot of what are called social determinants of health, all those factors that either can lead to or hinder an adult being healthy in all aspects of their life, that's something that's been a huge focus of the state and FSSA in particular over the last couple of years. So they still have this system where they have the ability to link people up to educational opportunities, volunteer opportunities, job training supports, getting their GED. And that's cooperation between FSSA and all of the managed care entities or insurers, the work with the Healthy Indiana Plan. They hired more people for that. They staffed up and got prepared for that. That shell is still very much there. So if we want to look at what could be done at this point, really all we've done is, at least temporarily, remove that punitive aspect, that aspect that if you don't do these things, you could lose your coverage. You know, as a student of human behavior, I would know, and I think most of our audience knows too, to say, you know, when there's a threat of losing something, we usually tend to do just enough to remove that threat. We don't excel very far past that, right? That threat, we'll meet it. We'll get to that minimum, maybe go a couple of steps over it just to play it safe. Mm. But again, we're playing it safe. We're playing defense. So now we really have an opportunity actually in this time to say, what happens if we shift that brand a little bit and we look at, we've got all these positive tools. Can we flood the market with these positive tools to get folks to a better place? You know, the insurers like it because it gets their consumers healthier. And yes, it's less cost to the state and the insurers. The consumers get to a better place. And if they are able to move closer to good gainful employment that actually can be a sustainable wage, if they're able to get their GED, and most people on the Healthy Indiana Plan don't have a high school diploma, so that's a big barrier to their future too. If we can really push hard into those zones and treat it as all the opportunity in the world to shift that paradigm, remove that punitive aspect and say, we are truly here to help you and partner with you and create something sustainable for the rest of your life, that would be, by all intents and purposes, the best possible outcome from all of this.
How was the reporting going before the work requirements were suspended? Were enough people doing it?
You know, and we have, you know, largely anecdotal, but we can say that of the amount that we're supposed to report, and by the way, out of over 400,000, only about 70,000 were deemed that they needed to report. The rest were already actually employed or being a caregiver to a young child, or they were in school. So the vast majority, just based on the state looking at raw data, didn't have to do the program because they were already doing what it required. That remaining group, we definitely heard that the reporting rate in the initial couple of months, which again, they had the rest of the year to get their hours in. But over that first period, 10% or less in the first month and a half, 2 months, were actually logging in and reporting hours. So it showed that there was some level of disconnect and a pretty substantial one. And I'm sure the state was watching that closely, and they were looking at strategies to implement to try to make sure those folks were communicated with better and had opportunities to meet their hours. But it had to be a scary moment for a lot of folks.
Does the state seem to know it was a problem?
Oh, they absolutely knew it was a problem, and they were creating a lot of educational modules and other tools. They had a whole team of folks that were going to try to make hard outreach and phone calls to those individuals who are at risk and saying, hey, it sounds like you're not quite understanding how the system works. Let's walk you through it. Let's triage that case a little bit. So they were definitely doing, from what we can tell, all the steps that could be done. It's really a matter if they were working with a system that was just going to have too many barriers, and if these were people that maybe had barriers that we didn't know about yet, mental health disorders that weren't on the state's radar, other things going on where they didn't have transportation or reliable phone line or who knows what else. So again, the opportunity comes back to what can we do now that we've identified some of these people? How can we truly assist them without a punitive aspect?
Are there any other Medicaid programs or initiatives that the state is considering adding?
There's a lot of things that they're working on. The biggest program, again, that I mentioned earlier was they want to add to the Healthy Indiana Plan, that program called HIP Bridge, that would give them income of $1,000. That would give them $1,000 to purchase insurance or to pay for their health coverage in the interim. They've actually expanded some other programs like early pre-K and like the child care voucher program that helps pay for child care for low-wage working adults. So there's a lot of programs they've really been building on. And that's, again, out of that whole social determinants of health office where they're realizing we've got to work with a lot of things to lift people out of poverty. It's not going to just be one magical solution.
Let's talk about the HIP Workforce Bridge program. How important is it to help people make the transition there? It's referred to as a cliff sometimes when you suddenly aren't eligible for programs that were making a big difference.
Right. Absolutely. And it's a very realistic cliff. And we like to talk about how the economy is getting better in Indiana and people are making more income and doing well. And that's true. But it's almost, you know, the HIP program was created about that newly poor group we saw during the recession. Now we have what I'm deeming the newly less poor group, where they're pulling themselves out of that slow and steady. But they've got programs and stuff that really help them get to that point, and they're going to need some assistance to get to the next stage where they can be truly independent. So things like healthcare, risking the loss of that just as you're doing better for yourself, it could be something that keeps you employed because of any issues you have going on. When we talk about substance use disorder, that's an excellent case where whether they're on some kind of medication-assisted treatment, they're seeing a counselor, and we know the cost of counseling and mental health services and all of that in general can be quite high. If there's anything we can do to make sure that there's no gap during that time for either those individuals or other ones with high-risk medical conditions, that's what's going to keep them employed. That's what's going to get them to the next level. So that $1,000, though it seems like a small amount, even if it's a few months of keeping them covered before they can get employer coverage signed up and get that started up again, that could be life-saving for some individuals.
Do you see common problems pop up for people who make that transition and suddenly have to shop for health insurance or get it from an employer?
Absolutely. And a couple of things. One, it's a confusing system. It's hard to move insurance at all. I think most of our listeners would say if I gave them a quiz on all of their deductibles and copays and everything else, they probably wouldn't know that. I can't pretend to have mine memorized.
I would not. I would not do well with that at all.
Right. And moving from something like Medicaid, where it is a little bit more prepackaged for you, or the Healthy Indiana Plan, they've got a lot of terms and things to learn. They've got to not fall into those traps of some of the more predatory things where they say for $30 a month, we'll insure you, except the insurance doesn't cover anything and has a $12,000 deductible. So there's a lot of things they have to learn in that place. There's some new expenses that come with that, too. And there's either less comprehensive coverage or there's coverage that maybe it's employer-sponsored, but not every employer. They might pay for the employee themselves, but they're not paying that family share. So they might be on the hook for $500 to $600 a month worth of family insurance, which is actually a great case for that children's health insurance program that we talked about earlier in the show. If we could expand eligibility to that and let folks buy into that, we'd be talking about a cost of between $50 and $200 on family size or on how much money you're making, but to have good comprehensive coverage and not have to roll the dice with your children's health care, something no parent wants to do.
We're hearing from listeners on Facebook and Twitter, and if you'd like to chime in, you can do so at All In Indiana on Facebook or Twitter. Elizabeth writes, I moved back to Indiana after living in Colorado for years and being on Colorado Medicaid for two of those years. I haven't been able to work for 2 years and need to apply for disability. I applied for Medicaid in June and was approved for retroactive coverage in July, but with benefits not actually kicking in until September. I since have been fighting the Gateway to Work program for months to apply for an exemption based on being too medically frail to work before the suspension. The policy and requirement being problematic for a number of reasons aside, navigating this process through Gateway to Work is frustrating due to the lack of transparency and information provided to me at any point. Adam, this doesn't seem particularly popular.
No.
and a lot of what we've looked at going into this has shown the same.
Yeah. I'll also say to that individual, we help folks. So we do a lot of work. Many people don't know that wherever you are in sort of the healthcare benefits system, if you're having issues, we can help folks with that. And if you're eligible for Medicaid, you probably qualify for our services. Indiana Legal Services is a free legal service provider. And so I can always provide information to folks about that. But yeah, I think that the thing that I want to say about this, and I think this maybe also speaks to a point that Mark was making earlier, that he didn't hear a lot from folks about the reporting and those sorts of issues. Oftentimes, folks that are sort of getting by paycheck to paycheck or sort of the low-income demographics, we don't hear there's a problem until they go to the pharmacy, try to pick up their medication to hear that their coverage has ended. And then they find out, well, 3 months ago, they didn't submit the right piece of paper, that sort of thing. Those are the sort of barriers. We know that there's just some of those things are always going to be intrinsic in some of these programs. But the problem for our clients is when you start adding more and more of those pieces, does it become more of a problem?
What's your sense on the general knowledge people have about their rights and about what they can challenge if something seems unfair?
Very low. You know, it's funny. We talk about this. All of these programs, they're government-run programs or entitlements that you and I, if we're eligible, we are all entitled to, and we have due process. And when our programs, when we're not getting the benefits that we're entitled to, we have a right to contest that, right to appeal it, right to have counsel come and help. And so we try to do as much as we can with that. But the general knowledge is very low. Most people just sort of think, well, that's the way it is.
How have politics in Indiana factored into these changes? Conservative states like Indiana don't typically push to expand state programs like this, but it seems like the work requirement element might have helped to balance things out.
Well, I really can't comment sort of generally on the politics. I will say that we had a HIP program before we had the work requirements, and I don't know that Indiana got any more or less conservative, but I'll let Mark fuel the rest of that question.
Yeah, I think Mark, maybe we should have asked you. Yeah,
sure. And really, the work requirements, I think, looking politically, was more of a national trend coming from some certain aspects. As Adam said, we had the Health Indiana plan before all of this, and I don't think the work requirement was something that was necessitated suddenly in order to keep Health Indiana plan solvent or anything like that. I think it was just an overarching thing. And realistically, we see this every 10 years or so, different programs. This time, it's Medicaid and plans like the Health Indiana plan. In the past, it's been the food stamps program known as SNAP, other things like that. So it tends to be a popular item that comes through, gets pushed by a lot of national groups. So not unusual, but it is to note that they've never found it to be something that saves more money than it costs either.
And I just want to make one quick legal distinction that the some of the other programs like the TANF program, they actually Congress has said you can add these sort of work requirements and those sorts of things, but that's never been the case for the Medicaid Act.
Adam Mueller is Advocacy Director for Indiana Legal Services. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
And Mark Fairchild is Director of Policy and Communication at Covering Kids and Families of Indiana. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our Managing Editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past shows, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow is the Friday Pitch-In. We're going to catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.